Health and Human Services to order. Going to open as a subcommittee and hold a public hearing on House Joint Memorial 1. Just to have staff introduce the...
Thank you, Senator. House Joint Memorial 1 urges Congress to equalize Medicare reimbursement rates among geographic areas nationwide. As some background, HJM 1 was pre-session filed by the Joint Interim Committee on Health and Human Services, which during the interim reviewed and visited a number of rural healthcare facilities around the state. A common concern in those visits and information heard at during hearings was that Medicare reimburses Oregon lower than other states, and rural areas are even less reimbursed than the urban areas. The Healthcare Finance Administration, or HCFA, administers Medicare, which covers 37 million Americans. Medicare consists of Part A, which covers hospitals, Part B, which covers physicians and related services. Federal payments to Medicare plus choice managed care organizations are calculated on a formula called the Average Adjusted Per Capita Cost, or AAPCC. This formula is based on a historical county-by-county medical care cost, and using this approach, Oregon counties have traditionally had lower medical costs, so they get lower reimbursement rates. Until the passage of the current bill, the it's a Medicare-Medicaid State Children's Health Insurance Program Benefits Improvement and Protection Act of 2001, there was a lower reimbursement. The state, rural, and urban reimbursement rates are now coming closer to national average. However, there is still some variation between Oregon and other states, especially between rural and urban areas of the state. And attached to is some additional information, of just facts on this memorial.
Okay, thank you. We have Jim Davis of the Oregon State Council of Senior Citizens, United Seniors of Oregon, and Verna Porter, Oregon State Council of Seniors and a Medicare Justice Coalition. Congress, I believe it is.
I'm Verna Porter. I'm with the Medicare Justice Coalition, Oregon Council of Senior Citizens, and with the United Seniors of Oregon. Okay. I'm a retired nurse, and when I heard of these inequities, I heard them out in the community, and was very shocked by them. My friend here, Joe Koss, who works with Jim Davis, told me basically about the Medicare Justice Coalition. The statistics, basically, you know, at one point Deschutes County received the lowest Medicare reimbursements in the United States. I always say I bring up the emotional stuff because I always seem to have the horror stories that I tell. That just recently, right here in this building, a gentleman was telling me about his friend in Coos County that is 80, working at a Walmart store, and the reason he works is to pay his supplementary insurance for his Medicare, and he had triple bypass surgery and was back in work in 3 weeks so he could continue to pay his insurance premiums. I dwell on those a little bit because when I walk into my neighborhood, I live in northeast Portland, not a poor neighborhood, not a rich neighborhood. There are a lot of senior citizens back at work, and part-time, some of them full-time, some of them a lot older than I am. I'm 66. What they are doing is working to pay for supplemental insurance for Medicare. They're working to pay for prescription drugs, et cetera, et cetera. I'm going to leave some of the more basic facts to Joe and just go from there.
Thank you.
I'm going to gavel up to a public hearing now. We have a majority of our committee with us, and I might just mention that Senator Carter has been excused for an illness in the family.
Boy, Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to come speak before you today. My name is Joe Koss, and I come before you as a representative of both the Oregon State Council of Senior Citizens and the Oregon Medicare Justice Coalition. The coalition was formed about a year ago in order to join a growing national effort originating in Minnesota to end Medicare's managed care reimbursement inequities. Both the State Council of Senior Citizens and the Oregon Medicare Justice Coalition support House Joint Memorial 1. This memorial acknowledges the unjustifiable inequities resulting from formulas now used to determine the reimbursement rates paid to providers of Medicare managed care services. We applaud this memorial's call for Congress to develop an approach that more equitably reimburses providers of managed health care services to America's senior citizens. Oregon is not alone in this concern over Medicare inequity. Organizations and elected officials across the country have expressed similar opinions on the current state of Medicare managed care reimbursement. Even the judicial branch has weighed in on this matter. United States District Court Judge Donald Alsop referred to the current system as a gross, unequal treatment of senior citizens and called for those with ultimate authority to promptly recognize the injustice they have created and enact legislation to correct it. Although congressional action at the end of last year did provide partial relief for the problems of the current system by raising the reimbursement rate, which also significantly improved conditions for Oregon's managed care providers, the fundamental problems associated with the reimbursement formula still exist. The Oregon Medicare Justice Coalition will continue to work with others across the country to bring about a final solution to this problem. Legislative action such as that reflected in House Joint Memorial 1 enhances the credibility of our efforts, and we thank the sponsors of this memorial for their willingness to officially respond to this issue, and we hope that this committee will vote to support it. In attachment to the testimony I have given you today is a fact sheet on the Oregon Medicare Justice Coalition for your further information. And if you have any questions, I'll be glad to entertain them now.
Senator Mathers.
Mr. Chair, one of the good things about being a newcomer to the Health and Human Services Committee is I can ask dumb questions. But I really, when I look over some of these figures, I have to ask the justification for the widespread between urban and rural reimbursement. And I simply don't know. It doesn't make sense to me, because it would seem to me that in the urban areas where the doctors can have a fuller schedule, more patients, that they have the opportunity to make much more money than they do in rural Oregon. And the costs are equally as high, I believe. So I'm not addressing this question to anyone specifically, but if there's anyone that can help me out, I'd appreciate it.
Probably I could answer that in about one or two words, and that is voting strength.
In actuality, the cost of providing health care services in the rural areas are higher than they are in the urban due to transportation issues around access to necessary care, transportation issues, and the availability of some of the diagnostic and treatment equipment that is relatively more expensive in the rural areas because you have fewer people using them to support their existence.
Chair, follow up. So maybe I'm not clear. Is the purpose of this bill comparing Oregon with other states, or are you talking about the rural-urban difference?
Both.
Both.
Yeah, we're looking at the problem as being one that is of national scope, and Oregon is just indicative of the problems that exist in other states, New Mexico, Minnesota, and many in the western part of the United States. Those that have better benefits are pretty much in targeted areas around Florida, New York, Pennsylvania, in some parts of Los Angeles and Arizona. And it's going to be a relatively difficult battle politically to attempt to get equity because of the political power that those representatives have. But we are planning now in the Medicare Justice Coalition's policymaking committee to put together some suggestions and recommendations to help resolve this problem as a win-win and not making it a sacrifice on the part of those that have, so that those that have not can have something more.
Mr. Chair, just a yes. comment. I see this as a major problem why we have trouble getting services to rural Oregon. And until we can address this, you know, part of my district, particularly Brookings, is the highest percentage of retired people in the state of Oregon, and they need services. They have a horrible time trying to get enough health services. And I, during the campaign, tried to discuss with people and tried to sort through what we can do to change that situation. I said at the time, I'm becoming more convinced as I learn more about this issue that it really is a federal issue. I mean, there's some things we can do in Oregon, but the basis of it, I believe, is a federal issue.
It is.
That's correct.
Thank you. On our travels through the, it's too bad we couldn't have had the senators that are on this committee with us on our rural tours, but it was very evident that when you're dealing with an 85% and maybe as high as 88, 89% Medicare and Medicaid census in those local hospitals, there's no way that the 15% of other folks can make up the difference in what they don't pay.
Yeah, and just a point of information.
The state has done a little bit along these lines, but no more than it absolutely had to, and not enough to really make that big of a difference.
Just as a point of information about the disparity across the country, in states like Florida, the reimbursement rate for managed for Part B Medicare is about $800 a month. And even with the improvement that we had at the end of last session of the Congress, our rates have only come up to about 40%. We're at about $524 or so dollars. So there's still about a 40% discrepancy between those two rates. And they say nationally that the difference in providing health care only ranges about 15% across the country. So there's still a lot of work to be done to repair this problem.
Mr. Chair, could I ask one more question? As I read this fact sheet that I guess Rick put out, Oregon has a minimum floor amount. Do we have a cap? I see the other states have a low.
Yeah, it doesn't indicate that we go on up from 475. Right. It indicates basically that we're stuck at 475 and 525.
Is that accurate?
That is correct at this point. Those are the reimbursement rates in our area. Because those are the minimum rates, and we were below the minimum rates before this took effect.
Most of our citizens in this state, as well as other states, think that this isn't a federal issue. They feel that wealthier states have some input into this. They don't realize it's all federal, Medicare funds, and there's no understanding of the issue. Or it's getting better. We're helping.
Yeah, we're doing our job.
But. The discrepancy is completely misunderstood.
So, Mr. Chair, our 5.25 is the one figure. We don't have a spread like the other states?
No, because we don't have anything. We never had anything that was above 525. So everything has been raised to the new minimum in Oregon and many other states. And there are states that are above that, in the $600 and $700 range, and they weren't affected by this congressional action at the end of last year. And now they're going to be the funding a blend program, which actually is another federal solution to this problem, where every year where cost of living increases are initiated and implemented, those states that are below the average get a higher percentage annual increase for inflation than those states that are above it. So it's just for example, if the inflation rate that was approved was 3%, the states would all get 3%, and those below the average would get a progressively greater increase, so that eventually we would come to a middle ground where everybody was getting closer to the median.
Okay. Thank you very much. Ed Patterson.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Ed Patterson. I represent the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. I'd be remiss if I didn't thank you, Mr. Chair, and some of your colleagues who spent time in rural parts of the state last summer and learned of this issue and consequently had this measure drafted, and we do appreciate that. I would also be remiss if I didn't indicate that we have had a great deal of help from our congressional delegation. Senator Gordon Smith, Senator Ron Wyden were very instrumental in getting some fixes, at least beginning to in Congress. Congressman Greg Walden and Congresswoman Darlene Hooley were also very helpful in that, and they recognize that there is in Oregon a serious problem in terms of the inequity of the Medicare reimbursement rate. And I think we are beginning at least to solve the problem. As was alluded to earlier, in the what is called the blended rate, the problem goes back to the 1997 Balanced Budget Act, and that's when they decided to squeeze down on Medicare reimbursement. And the blend part of that measure that passed in Congress was not funded in the final days of the 1997 Congress. And so consequently, Oregon did take a huge hit for all Medicare reimbursement. Having said that, I need to tell you that this issue is not really an issue of provider reimbursement so much as it's an issue of how our Medicare recipients are treated in the state. As an example, because of the great disparity between what the Medicare reimbursement rate is in Oregon and what it is in some of the higher cost states such as California, New York, and Florida, the managed care rate is some $800 in Florida and New York, and has already been alluded to, some $500 here in Oregon. So the Medicare recipients are receiving more services. As an example, vision care, pharmacy coverage, a dental care, which is not provided for Medicare recipients in the state of Oregon. So it really is an inequity issue in terms of what Medicare patients receive. We think that our delegation is on top of this issue. We're part of my organization is certainly part of another national organization consisting of low-cost states. And while we have made significant strides to resolve the issue, there's still a lot of work to be done. So this memorial, I think, will serve as a reminder not only to our delegation in Congress, but also to the rest of the states who are suffering from some of the same low-cost reimbursement as ours. That we need to stay on top of it. So we do appreciate the fact that you've introduced the memorial as an interim committee, and hopefully you will support this on the Senate floor. Be happy to respond to any questions.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator George.
I want to thank you for inviting me last summer to go on part of that tour of my district on the Central Oregon coast. It was the first time I really was aware of this, and I have to tell you, I've been mad ever since. And what I'm going to ask all of you to do, and that is, this is going to go back to Congress, and they're going to look at it, and they'll throw it in the pile. But one thing that really makes a difference, when they see a pile of letters coming in from legislators with our letterhead on the top of that saying, look, this is not fair, and we expect fairness here. We expect to be treated fairly. So if you guys will keep us informed as to when would be the appropriate time to fire off those letters, I think you'll have probably all of the legislators joining in that effort. So it wasn't a question. I'm sorry. I'm always doing that.
That's good advice.
I'm a little bit fired up about
it. Yes, good.
Incidentally, for the new members of the committee here, we did write a letter supporting this very thing and sent it back during the interim from the co-chairs and the co-committee on Health and Human Services. So this is a kind of a follow-up and another installment on the effort. Further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Thank you. Did either one of you, Ms. Porter or Mr. Cost, do you know if Jim Davis wishes to speak to this, or is he?
If he could get back on time, he would, but I think he kind of left the information to us, and so if need be, we could go on.
Okay, I would appreciate it if people don't sign in other people's names.
You know, he did.
He signed.
He
got, oh, he did?
He got pulled away.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not necessary to wait for him. I think we brought the information.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, I'm going to go from public hearing, close the public hearing, and open a work session on House Joint Memorial 1. Is there a motion to adopt it?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I move Senate Joint Memorial Number 1 to the floor with a due pass.
Okay.
And what?
We have to move to adopt.
Oh, move to adopt, okay.
Senator George moves to adopt House Joint Memorial 1 and send it to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Any objection? Senator Shields also is excused, so he and Senator Carter are excused. Will clerk call the roll?
Senator Mesley?
Aye.
Senator George?
Aye.
Chair Fisher?
Aye. The motion carries.
I have a little fire in my belly. Can I carry this one?
Senator George will carry, and the motion passes.
I guess not.
Looks like my gavel just opened the door.
Yeah, I heard it.
Senator Messerly, could we have a motion to suspend the rules?
I move we suspend the rules to allow Senator Shields to vote.
Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. We'll reopen the work session on House Joint Memorial number one. How do you vote?
I vote aye.
Senator Shields votes aye. And I will, Senator George is carrying this, so, and it did carry, so. I'll close the work session on House Joint Memorial number one and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 562. Will the clerk or the staff introduce it?
Thank you, Senator. Senate Bill 562 expands the authority of licensed dental hygienists to provide services under a limited access permit to individuals in certain facilities and to children and students in certain programs, schools, or training facilities. As a little background, dental hygienists primarily provide us a number of intraoral and extraoral procedures. You normally know them as cleaning teeth and related types of services. A dental hygienist must graduate from an accredited dental hygiene program, be licensed by the state, and be supervised by a licensed dentist. Dental hygienist may be issued a limited access permit that allows the person to perform unsupervised dental hygiene services in nursing homes, adult foster homes, residential care, adult congregate living facilities, and programs administered by the Mental Health and Developmental Disability Service Division. To receive a limited access permit, a hygienist must fulfill certain requirements, such as holding a valid unrestricted dental hygienist license, have at least 5,000 hours of supervised dental hygiene clinical practice within the previous 5 years, present proof of current professional liability insurance, and present documentation for a total of 40 classroom hours of accredited courses in such areas as general medicine, pharmacology, emergency care, cardiopulmonary resuscitation, and similar training. Under a limited access permit, each calendar year, the hygienist must refer each patient to a dentist, and hygienists are not allowed to conduct anesthesia, provide sealants, perform similar services under this permit.
Thank you. Call Paul Cosgrove of the Oregon Dental Hygienists Association and Joanne Bones, Board of Dentistry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Paul Cosgrove, representing the Oregon Dental Hygienist Association, and your staff has done an excellent job of summarizing what Senate Bill 562 does. It was introduced at the request of the Oregon Dental Hygienist Association. This is not a scope of practice bill in that it does not change anything about what limited access permit dental hygienists are able to do. It simply adds several locations where they are able to perform these services. And the first set of locations are similar to the ones in the original bill, which was enacted by this legislature in 1997, and adds certain institutions in the, administered by the Mental Health Division. We're talking about state hospitals and training schools in that respect. And secondly, it adds schools, from nursery schools through public, private, and charter schools. And I'd like to spend just a moment about that issue. Oregon faces a especially serious shortage of dental professionals, and it's especially acute with respect to those who serve children. And there's some data in my testimony. About 13 Oregon counties have either no dentists or a shortage of dentists under federal guidelines. 25 Oregon counties have no pediatric dentists, although some general dentists, of course, obviously provide services to children. 9 Oregon counties have a ratio of dentists to low-income population that is 5 times the standard for critical shortage. And over, this is the most stunning statistic to me, and it came from testimony delivered by our dental health officer just last week in front of the House Health Services and Public Advocacy Committee. Over one half of Oregon children 12 and younger have never had a dental visit. So our goal here is to allow dental hygienists who've received this extra training and have this kind of experience and this kind of certification to provide dental hygiene services, not dental services. They're going to stay within the scope of their license at schools and other places where children are, to refer those folks into dentists, and especially those who have acute problems, hopefully encourage them to see dentists as soon as possible, and hopefully reduce that stunning statistic and get better dental health care to our children. We'd urge your support of SB 562, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Senator Fisher, members of the committee, I'm Joanne Bones. I'm the executive director of the Board of Dentistry. The Board of Dentistry voted unanimously on February 9th to support this bill. It's a natural extension of an increase in the sites of places where limited access dental hygienists can practice, and the board requests that you support the bill.
Okay. Senator Shields.
I'm just thinking about the scenario here. With a limited number of dentists in the state, if the hygienists are out doing this, they're referring more patients to the dentist, how are the dentist going to keep up with the workload? I mean, do you follow what I'm saying?
If I may respond in part, Chair Fisher, Senator Shields, there are other things that need to be done to address this problem. This is not the only solution. And one of those, frankly, is a bill that has been introduced at the request of the Oregon Dental Association, and that is to consider reopening the pediatric dentistry program at OHSU, a program closed several years ago. Now, there's a price tag to that, and unfortunately, with lots of kinds of professional education, the price tag is relatively high. But that is one of the other methods. There's actually, I think, a developing national shortage, at least in some other states, of dental resources, and whatever we can do to help encourage, to maximize the use of whatever resources we have and encourage people to stay in Oregon, particularly in rural Oregon, will help. So this is only one piece of the solution. But at least if dental hygienists, as part of these services in schools, find kids, they can encourage, maybe they were unknown problems, and they can encourage those parents to get to those dentists and get them on the list rather than ignoring the problem until some pain or other symptom causes them to know they have to go to a dentist. In this case, like in all cases, prevention is always better than cure after the fact.
Senator Fisher, Senator Shields, if I may respond partially to Senator Shields' question. There are also services, preventive services, that a dental hygienist and a dental assistant can perform without a dentist being directly involved at all points. For instance, a dental assistant and a dental hygienist may apply sealants once the dentist has ordered those. So it would take a very small amount of a dentist's time, but more clinic time from the hygienist. It may help prevent further cavities in children from developing.
One follow-up. Did this statistic that Paul shared come as a shock or a surprise to you? I mean, it sounds incredible, and I'd like to hear it again to make sure my ears were working. The 50% of kids under 12 or something like that have never been to a dentist at all? Okay. Is that what you said?
Yes, and this is a testimony from Dr. Whitney Payne, who is in the health division. He is Oregon's dental health officer, and he gave this in the House Health and Public Advocacy Committee last week. There are two statistics, only one of which I mentioned. I'll read you the full thing. Only one-fourth of Oregon health plan children had a dental visit in 1999. That's one-quarter of the Oregon health plan children. And half of Oregon's children 12 years age and younger have never had a dental visit. That's half of all children. That's not an Oregon health plan statistic, as I understand it from Dr. Payne.
Now, my question is, if that's true, what's the prognosis, doctor?
Senator Fischel, Senator Shields, I hope that's rhetorical. Certainly the board is working on the issue of addressing licensure and opening up the avenues of licensure in Oregon, but nationally there is developing a shortage of dentists. There are only 54 accredited dental schools in the United States and 3,900 new graduates. Only a certain number of those are going to be coming to Oregon. One of the things the board is looking at is increasing the duties that hygienists and assistants can do to lessen the workload of a dentist so that they can spend more time on the clinically more difficult tasks so that some prevention efforts and front-end things can be done by the fully trained but less expensive dental hygienists and dental assistants. And we've made some roads into that, and they're working, the board is working further on the whole problem. But until we get more dental schools and more graduates, the problem of enough dentists so that everybody can go is just going to be problematic.
Would that be the type of program or something that might require considerable more education on the part of, for instance, a dental assistant? I'm not sure what the current standards are. When I took the dental assistant training, it was approximately an eight-week course, and it certainly didn't prepare you to do any kind of treatment or anything in the process. It just strictly got you acquainted with the tools, with the processes, with the placement of x-rays, that kind of thing, and certainly didn't give you anything at all in the, even as far as using a mouth mirror and explorer to do an exam. Mm-hmm.
Well, Senator Fischer, one thing that I mentioned that the board has done has allowed dental assistants to place sealants after taking an approved course, and the board's approved course is simply 6 hours. Once they've taken that course and been tested, they receive the certification. This is on top of their expanded function dental assistant certification that they gotten earlier, but it does increase the capacity. We're certifying 800 new dental assistants a year versus 150 new dentists and new dental hygienists.
How extensive now for time is a dental assistant course?
Senator Fischer, I'm sorry, I don't actually know how long a dental assistant course is. It's given in many of the community college programs, but I don't know how many hours it takes.
It wouldn't be anything anyway near as significant as the training that a hygienist receives.
Certainly not.
But if a hygienist, if we followed the nursing or the doctors, we'd say dentist assistant, as adverse to a dental assistant,
Senator
or
Fischer.
a dental practitioner.
Well, I'm not clear of the analogy you're trying to make, Senator Fischer, but a dental.
That these different ones, in other words, the physicians have said, you know, there's lots of things that we can properly spin off to people that have less than all the medical school that we go through as physicians, and therefore they've made the physician assistant that comes in there and does those things, and they can operate or do things under supervision and things that, especially in rural areas, the same as a nurse practitioner. But I'm saying that something like that, if they were to say that somebody could, under the service or the supervision of a dentist, perform fillings and that kind of simple fillings and things like that, but the dentist would first look over and said, yeah, this is a simple procedure and you can go ahead with it. I mean, something like that would still take several years of training, not just 8 weeks or something like that. So we're not really looking to be able to convert a dental assistant as such into somebody that could actually take much of the technical load off of a dentist or further his or her work.
Right, Senator Fisher, you're correct. The analogy I would make is that a dental assistant is much like a nursing assistant who's had a small amount of several hours of training, 40 or 100 or whatever, and like I said, I don't know exactly how many it is, whereas a dental hygienist is more like the nurse who's received a two-year nursing degree. Many dental hygienists have received a four-year degree. We don't have a level between the hygienist and the dentist as there are nurse practitioners. That's another step, I suppose, that the education program could take, but I'm not aware that there's any going like that.
Well, I personally foresee a time when we don't turn down any avenue of search for ways of providing quality treatment at lesser cost and more convenience to the person receiving it. So I was curious when you mentioned about some of the other procedures and things that you were looking at. Wanted to pursue that just a little bit. I understand that prisons were supposed to be included.
Mr. Chairman, yes, Paul Cosgrove again. When this bill was originally submitted to Legislative Council, it had a different additional paragraph about corrections institutions, which somehow in the process of drafting just got dropped off. It wasn't for a particular reason. It just literally got dropped off. And by the time I noticed it, it was already ready to be submitted to be dropped, and I went ahead to pursue that. If the chair agrees and the committee agrees to take action on this bill today, we would propose that when we get to the House side, I'm still working on the exact language and need to go through LC to make sure that gets drafted, that we would add those provisions. It would just add another set of institutions in which these hygienists could perform these functions, and those would be the corrections institutions. It's a little harder to draft that, ironically, because corrections institutions in the state are run by all sorts of regional, local, and state governments, and we're trying to get the exact wording. I had a proposal in the original draft that we need to run through LC and make sure it's right.
I have really kind of refrained from sending bills out when we knew there were amendments, and in fact that we're not in a real press at the moment to get, we have plenty of time, and unless there was a real press on this, I'd prefer not to send a bill over. They had to work too much on in the House. They're going to have a lot of things to do to get their work done because of so many members in the House and heavier workload.
And that's fine, Mr. Chairman. I mentioned to your administrator earlier today that I gave him the language we'd submitted, so I can work with him to see that we get that through Legislative Council to bring back to the committee for your consideration.
Senator Shields?
I was just going to suggest the same thing. If you're interested in the bill, I'd like to see him go ahead and get the amendments.
We have one other person that wishes to testify, Jane Myers.
Mr. Chairman,
Sorry.
Paul and Joanne, could you guys help us with this question of expanded practice? Would it be possible for you to research other states, see if they have any additional training programs that might enable some of these folks other than the dentist to actually perform some of the intermediate practices that Bill made reference to? It would be interesting for us to have that.
Senator Fisher, Senator Fisher, Senator George, certainly we could do that, and I can't at this moment say what the status of other states are. The one thing I'd point out is that dental hygienists, in comparison to assistants and dentists, dental hygienists have a different scope. Not that a dentist can't perform these same services, but they're also particularly directed toward prevention, preventing problems so as to hopefully eliminate or reduce the need for treatment that is typically within the realm of dentists and dental assistants in an office setting. So they have that extra prevention piece. But we could certainly take a look at, and I'll try to get the American Dental Hygiene Association and what other resources we have to see what other levels there might be. Thank you.
Thanks.
Jane?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jane Myers. I represent the Oregon Dental Association, which represents 75% of the dentists who practice in the state of Oregon. I wrote down that we're opposed to the bill. I'm happy to hear that you're considering some amendments to it. I should go into two things about the issue itself. There was some talk on the committee about quality of service. I also think that is a very important aspect of what this bill is about. But there's also an aspect that I, as a representative and a lobbyist for the Dental Association, have to point out, that some of the quality of information that legislators receive needs to come up to a certain standard. I hear, and this isn't the first time I've heard it, discussions of extreme or serious shortages of dentists in our state. Most of that is based on a health division study. The health division study is pretty much formulated by the federal government. Its purpose is to identify communities that will be eligible for some federal money grants to help them provide more services. When they look at information, they look at the people in need, which also includes those in the Oregon Health Plan, but they look at it as if the Oregon Health Plan does not exist and is not delivering data. So their data tends to overstate shortages, and they come up with things like one dentist to 4,000 or 5,000 people. Now, the ODA has information that's a little more direct, where we looked at the American Dental Association's numbers of practicing dentists, active dentists in states, compared to the population of those states. And we get statistics that Oregon is like 10th down from the top of the list, the District of Columbia having the most dentists per population. So we're not doing bad. We have like one on that list, one to every 1,600 people in the state. Our own comparisons from the Board of Dentistry licensing information, another survey that the Dental Association put together, shows statistics for population to dentists in the state of Oregon and the different cities, and we don't come up with anything near approaching serious shortages. I'm not arguing that there aren't some shortages. I want you to understand it's the quality of the information that this committee and other committees are receiving that should be put in question. It's not fair to think that in enacting Senate Bill 562 that you're going to make a big dent in any kind of shortage area. There are, as I understand it, 13 to 15 people who have a limited access permit in the state, and no good numbers exist on whether they're actually treating people in the facilities that they're already allowed to treat in. The referral that's required of them by statute to refer their limited access patients to a dentist once a year is very much resisted at the Board of Dentistry's level by the Oregon Dental Hygienists Association. When the original limited access permit was put together, it was the Oregon Dental Association working with the Oregon Dental Hygienists Association, and that was one of the key things that the dentist thought was a good idea, was that if the dental hygienist is in a limited access facility, that they would be able to link that person up with a dentist, because what kind of dental emergencies do you hear about from your constituents? They're the need to see a dentist, not to have their teeth cleaned. So if we don't take that step, if we don't make that linkage work somehow, I think we miss a step to help people in limited access facilities. And that's another thing I wanted to point out. The permit is for a limited access patient. And the idea of that was those are patients who have difficulty getting dental hygiene services, mostly because they're in facilities, where there are some limitations on their ability to be mobile or move about. So that's all well and good. But I did want to point out some of the language in the bill goes much farther than that. The on line 21, employment training, that's so broad as to be overly vague as to what that is. They mean Job Corps, but then they also include employment training centers. I also want to state, yes, the pediatric dentists are in short supply, and that's a national problem. I'm delighted for any attention the legislature wants to give to that issue. I don't know where the statistic about 50% of children 12 and younger have not seen a dentist. I'd really like somebody to give me some, whether it's the dental director.
50% had braces.
Where that number is actually coming from, because a good number, probably about 15% of the people in Oregon counties are eligible for the Oregon Health Plan, and probably more than that number for our children are eligible for the Oregon Health Plan. So if they're not getting dental services, we need to, both the Oregon Dental Association, the dental hygienist, and I'd encourage legislators to look at why aren't they getting the services. The state is certainly paying for them. What are the real barriers to those services? Now, dental assistants and dental hygienists generally work with the supervision of a dentist. And I'm not, from what I've learned, I'm not going to stand here and encourage the placement of sealants by people who are not working under supervision of a dentist, because I've heard the dentist resist that. It sounds great, except that someone needs to examine the patient to see if they have what they call frank decay, because it's a great disservice to a patient to put sealants on teeth that have decay. And it's been done. It's been done. So in the name of providing a lot of services, more services, we're all for providing more services, but with some ideas or some constraints as to how those services are provided to make sure that the legislature gives solid direction both to the board about the permits and to the people who are getting the permits and using them. I think the board identified a screening issue. The chairman encouraged formation of a committee by the Board of Dentistry for discussion of dental hygiene issues, and there is identification of a screening issue, but the way I understood the screening issue was lay people in schools are trying to screen children, and they're having some problems about whether or not that's actually diagnosing, and we need to solve that issue for the parents or lay people in schools so that they can do more screening, so that the dental assistants can do more screening. And this bill doesn't address that. Perhaps we can fix the language so it does. I'll tell you another problem that I heard recently was some frustration, and this is on the part of a dentist from a rural part of the state who said, if we want to encourage more dentists in rural areas, and this would go for dental hygienists too, then we need to make sure that OHSU provides as many slots to people who want to study dentistry or dental hygiene from those rural areas as there are people who want to study from rural areas, because that is the way you most successfully draw people back to rural areas, are educating students who are from the area, who have friends and family and commitments to move back there. And from what I understand from, and this is two frustrated dentists who said they had children who had to go out of state to go to dental school. So those are some of the tip of the iceberg issues that I'd say would help take down some of the barriers. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions if I can.
Senator Shield.
Just for the sake of an argument for a minute, if, in fact, the 50% number is an accurate one, and I'd be glad to push the health division or whoever to document their findings, if 50% of the kids haven't ever seen a dentist, how can we say that there's plenty of dentists around? I mean, you were saying, yeah, there's some shortages, but you were arguing with the fact that the shortages aren't as great as they say. If there's so many dentists around, I can't understand why there's so many kids who've never seen a dentist.
Chairman Fisher and Senator Shields, if I can respond or try to the question. The question to me is, what is the real barrier? Why aren't children seeing dentists? If 50% of them are not seeing the dentist, is the reason because there are no dentists to see them, or is the bigger part of that reason because the parents do not understand that they can get dental services, have no motivation to take their children in for a dental appointment, or when they try to get a dental appointment, as I heard in one county, I believe it was Lincoln, there was some consumer complaint about a dental care organization over there was not making appointments for children. I'm not making them far out, but not making them, period. Those kind of issues need to be explored. So I don't know if that answers your question. There is the need for more pediatric dentists. That's certainly true, and those are the dentists who take care of the very young child with a great deal of dental disease, usually a great deal of decay, and frequently in hospitals, because if you can imagine a three-year-old child with extensive decay being treated in an open dental office where you've been in these, where the operatories are open to each other and the child needs anesthesia because most children are not going to cooperate at 3 years old with dental treatment that's that extensive. The general practitioners in our state don't have permits for, many of them do not, probably the majority don't have permits to do deep conscious sedation. So then we're looking at the pediatric dentists. Yes, they are in short supply, and there are waiting lists for them, and that's, this bill doesn't do anything about that. I mean, we can identify the issue until we reach the limits of identifying the issue. We need to get the pediatric program restarted. We need to make sure that the children under the Oregon Health Plan are getting the services that the state's paying for, or else we need to take that money and use it in a different way to get them services. We need to see if we can get water fluoridation implemented in some of the major cities in the state, such as Portland, which doesn't have water fluoridation right now. Those would be some ways to make sure children got a boost towards good oral health.
You would really put me on the spot, bring a bill like that up, wouldn't you? But I am considering it. I'm getting information on it right now.
Jane, just a follow-up. I'm still stuck with the idea that you've got 50% of the kids out there that haven't seen a dentist. You and I can talk all day about the reasons why. But my question is, what's the problem if they're not getting any dental health care now, for whatever reason, what's the problem with them at least having accessibility to a hygienist who can do some cleaning of their teeth, and when he or she really finds a problem, referring that child to a dentist? I don't understand.
Okay.
It's a difference between nothing at all and, I mean, in an ideal world, there'd be a dentist around and every child would see a dentist and that'd be great, but this isn't ideal. So why not at least take this half measure, which is going to clean up some kids' teeth and help some kids, rather than none of the 50%?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, so that gets right back to the question of who says 50% of children under 12 are not being seen by a dentist in our state? I mean, we beg the question.
But 40%, 30%, so what? I mean, even if it's 30%, and 30% of the kids never get to see a dentist, isn't it better for that 30% at least to get to see a hygienist?
And if the hygienist, if the child has decay,
which cleaning his teeth is going to hurt?
No, cleaning his teeth, the child's teeth is not going to hurt, but the second step is to make sure the referral is there.
Well, refer.
And that's a continuing point of contention when the ODA has asked in rulemaking, could we have some evidence of who is being seen and who's being referred to whom to make sure this bill that was passed a couple sessions ago is still working or is working. We get resistance. So will we ever know if you have hygienists seeing children and there is no system of making sure there are some records kept about who they were referred to if they were referred? Have we really done anything of importance to solve the problem?
How part of a process is this referral? And I notice here the law says at least once each calendar year a dental hygienist issued a permit to act as a limited access permit. Dental hygienist shall refer each patient or resident to a dentist who is available to treat the patient or resident.
How
onerous of a process is that?
Mr. Chair, it requires the dental hygienist to be aware of who is taking new patients in the area they're working in.
Well, but I mean, how much time and how much paperwork is it to the dental hygienist to have to go, what do they have to go through to prove that they have referred? Can they just say, hey, you need to see a dentist and to call it that, or do they have to go through some paper filling out process to show that they've complied?
Mr. Chair, right now there are no records, as we know, being kept of who they're referring to, and there won't be unless there is some requirement to, in their records, I mean, they have to keep patient records that they've treated someone. That's just part of the healthcare scenario, is one must have a patient record to initial in there who they told the dentist or the patient what dentist might be available to see them if they have a dental problem that needs a dentist to care for it, would be a matter of the record.
Mr. Chair.
What does available to treat mean?
Taking new patients, I would say, in the area.
Wouldn't many of these people logically have a dentist already?
Mr. Chair, many of them will have a dentist already.
And that their own family dentist would be a proper referral?
That would be a proper referral, yes.
But does it have to be in writing? I mean, if you said, hey, you know, I finished cleaning your teeth, and I noticed a couple places here, you better go see a dentist. Is that a referral? Or does it have to be, here's my prescription, do you go see a dentist, and you send it on to the dentist so he knows to contact him? Or
I don't know the process. Mr. Chairman, the way it was envisioned, right now there is no process, but the way it was envisioned was that when the patient is seen by the limited access permit hygienist, that there would be some information given to the patient about you still need to see a dentist. I mean, we don't want to give people the idea that if you have your teeth clean that you've necessarily done everything you need to do about maintaining oral health. Here are some dentists in our city who are seeing new patients. Or here is a name of a dentist I've talked to who will see new patients. Or here is a dentist who is under the Oregon Health Plan through your dental care organization who will see you. Here is an emergency number. Here's the governor's number for problems if you're in the Oregon Health Plan and you can't get a dentist. I mean, some indication of how to help the patient. Many of these people don't even know how their Oregon Health Plan will give them a dentist services if they are having a hard time finding them.
Senator Mesley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm having a little trouble following this conversation. It would seem to me to be relatively simple. Let me just say I came from the cattle business where we have to have livestock brand inspected and different departments have to be notified. And it seemed to me that it shouldn't be this difficult. A simple referral form with copies that go to the state, copies that go to the doctor, a copy goes in the patient's file, and we could cover this. I'm kind of going along the lines of Senator Shields that if we've got inadequacies in the system, why aren't we treating those children at least? And if this is an obstacle to it, it seems to me like getting a few people together, we could resolve this problem.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator George.
Gene, I'm looking at lines 24, 5, and 6, and you mentioned providing sealants. And if I'm reading this right, this says that nothing herein shall construe or authorize the limited access person to perform those things except under the general supervision of a dentist. I mean, we didn't change, the bill wouldn't change any of that language, correct? They would still be restricted.
Mr. Chair and Senator George, you're quite right. And yeah, that's a point of clarity. I was referring to the issue of dental assistants who also may do sealants and dental hygienists doing them under supervision, because that does give the dentist an opportunity to say that child has decay and needs to have the decay treated before the teeth receive the sealants, or that child doesn't have decay and you may go right ahead and seal the teeth.
Okay,
Mr. Chairman,
my point being that any of these people who would be going to deal with the mentally ill or a nursery school or daycare center, they wouldn't be providing any of those services. But I feel very secure, and it might be nice to tighten up the language about the referral to a dentist. But the main thing is they're very limited in their scope of practice to go in and deal with these additional facilities.
Well, you know, you get into a lot of different problems here, too, because you start getting into the care facilities and you have people that can't go to a dentist and the dentist has to come to them, and that isn't sometimes a very practical answer. to seeing massive amounts of people. Where I have 150 people plus or something like that, and somebody was performing this type of dental hygienist service, it'd be one whale of a mess for them to have to try to arrange to get a dentist in order to take care of those people. And I don't know how to put it in, you know, regardless of what we try to do, it's very difficult for a dentist, and very few dentists are willing to try to come in and actually work on someone's teeth when they're bedfast or that kind of thing. So it poses some real problems of referral, and that's why I was not going to want to make it too terribly tough on somebody to do the referral. Not only that, if you've got to send records off to half a dozen different places and everything, those things take a lot of time, and with the mail the way it is, it's no longer cheap.
Mr. Chair, did you want me to respond to the problem? The referral that we have discussed, at least at the Dental Association level with the Board of Dentistry in the past, has been record keeping for the dental hygienist, limited access permit hygienist. This doesn't involve sending records to a dentist. It would be good for the purposes of finding out, is the system working? Is there some way we can make it work better when there's a referral? When the hygienist says to the patient, Dr. Smith is taking new patients and he's in this city, and can I help you? Maybe you need to see a dentist. Help the patient get access to the dentist, not necessarily be sending records, but helping the patient make that contact. As an association staff person, we do it all the time for patients who call and are having a difficult time finding a dentist. There are many referrals going through the different county dental societies programs. If somebody can't qualify for the Oregon Health Plan and they still need help, I mean, we do have different programs. I guess it's not, I'm not talking about the kind of referrals where the general practitioner sends records to the specialist, like the oral surgeon, and that sort of communication begins and it becomes onerous.
Yeah, I understand that, but when you say each person, each patient or resident to a dentist who is available, that puts, in the first place, they're supposed to be, as I see it, working under a dentist somewhere or another. And if they are, the dentist should have the responsibility of dragging those people in as much as they would. If somebody doesn't really need to be seen, and we're not going to require and demand that everybody have x-rays every year they go to school or something like this, it's pretty tough for them to have to try to go through a lot of paperwork and hard process in order to make sure that somebody gets referred. I don't know, you know, a note in a patient chart and allowing the staff to work with it would certainly, I would think, be notification. You know, it's how are you going to do it if you go to a nursery or something like that and check over a lot of little kids or do some work on them? It's going to be very difficult to chase that through and try to get to a parent and get the parent to take the kid to the doctor or that kind of thing. And it could be, you know, a referral to the daycare operator, whoever it is, or to the teacher that so-and-so needed it. They could go through the processes. I know when we were checked with kids for hearing and things like that by the school nurse, if anybody had a hearing problem, they turned around and recommended to the parent or made some kind of arrangement. Are we still doing those kind of things? We do it for hearing, maybe, and eyesight, but not dentistry or not kids' teeth.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would hope that we do. All of anyone who's doing any screening helps the patient or the person being screened find the services that they need. To do a screen in any kind of fashion to just dropped the ball there. I mean, I think people, the public is entitled to some help, especially when we're talking about limited access patients, in finding a dentist who is available to treat them. I guess I respectfully don't share that as an opinion that that's a terribly onerous thing to ask someone to do. We can certainly work on how it's done.
Did you say it was only about 13?
I understand there are 13 to 16 was the last number that I heard from the Board of Dentistry with the permit. And they don't have to be, these under the permit, there's no dentist involved. They don't have to work with a dentist. I want to make that point.
Oh, they don't?
Here. No.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Shield.
Jane, I just did some checking, and it's come to my attention that there's already administrative rules. This is a slightly different subject, but there's already administrative rules that address the issue of this referral, a hygienist doing a referral of somebody that they've done a cleaning on.
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, as far as I understand, the administrative rule repeats the statute. It doesn't demand any record or, I guess that's the point, is how do we make sure, do we do anything to gather any information about how this is helping the public get connected up with dental care that they need?
Yeah. Would like to ask Mr. Cosgrove and Ms. Bones to come back. We need to do some cross-examining here.
Mr. Chair,
very, very difficult in this kind of a...
I'd like to ask a question. But
certainly, go right ahead.
How does the...
We have three.
How does your association see to resolve this problem?
The problem of the referrals, excuse me if I...
The problem of the bill.
The problem of the bill. Our position is at the moment to oppose it. I think the Board of Dentistry could write a rule that would gather the same information from the limited access permit, the people who hold the permit right now, that would give some information about how it's working. Kind of some indicator that there is some work being done out there before extending it to other facilities would be welcome.
Mr. Chair, can I ask?
Yes, Senator Mesrin.
You question the figures that we've heard here today. Do you have figures to offer from your association and from knowledge which your membership have pulled together?
About the 50% of the children under 12, I'd really like to know where that figure comes from. There is some data available, encounter data for the Oregon Health Plan enrollment about children, but we don't collect information about who's being treated in Oregon for what treatments.
So I'm not asking you to challenge their data. I'm just asking if you have any data of your own, and you don't.
Sorry. Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Messerly, I will look for the data. I'm sure we must have some surveys or studies of what's happening in Oregon.
And is your main problem here is just expanding this without knowing yet what actually is being done in the past on this particular issue? Is that the prime concern of expanding this program without knowing yet whether people are being referred properly or having any assurance that they are?
Senator Fisher, yes, that is.
Maybe you could, the other people, address this issue.
Senator Fisher, Chair Fisher, Paul Cosgrove again. Just on a couple of the issues, the rules that the board has adopted, and they were adopted in June of 98, so this bill was effective in late 97. After the 97 session, rules were not adopted until 98. The reason there are not very many limited access permit hygienists yet is it takes a considerable amount of continuing education in order to get the permit, and then you have to function under the permit for a period of 2 years continuing to do more continuing education. So I don't think the numbers that Ms. Myers stated are at this point inaccurate, although we hope those numbers will expand in terms of the numbers of people, especially if we are able to provide access to schools where dental hygienists know there's a lot of prevention and education that needs to be done, and a lot of that education is in the need for people to go to the dentist. That may be one of the primary barriers. I don't have any data to support this statement, but it seems to me as a parent it may be one of the primary barriers for kids receiving dental care. It's not sometimes an obvious problem and maybe not the highest priority, and if they encounter a dental hygienist in a school setting who amongst his or her duties is to educate them about the need for dental care, that may encourage the parent to go to a dentist. But in any case, the record-keeping requirements are that the referral be noted in the chart, and if there are additional procedures authorized by a dentist beyond what is normally allowed by a limited access permit holder, which can be done with a dentist's authorization, that those also be noted in the chart and the authorizing dentist's name be noted in the chart. So there is already a process. That process could be revisited. My only concern is I don't think we want to, as the chair has pointed out in some of your earlier comments, I don't think we want to increase record-keeping requirements to the extent it reduces care. We need to have record-keeping requirements that are appropriate and good health care practice, and we need to be able to do that in a way that doesn't tie up everybody's time in record-keeping. I'm not sure the Board of Dentistry wants to have copies of every referral sent to it in this context, and that would be an additional record-keeping burden. I'm not sure that that would actually improve care for anyone. The chart has the information, and the charts could be audited to determine that.
How do these people get paid in schools and working with kids and stuff like that?
Mr. Chairman, most of that's going to be volunteer and unpaid. There may be, I suppose, some of those children who are Oregon Health Plan enrollees for whom dental hygienists could seek reimbursement under the Oregon Health Plan. There may be some of those who have private insurance for whom they could seek insurance reimbursement, but realistically, most of these are volunteer efforts that are unpaid.
Ms. Bones, did you wish to expound a little bit on the process whereby we make sure that these referrals take place or the provision you have?
Well, Senator Fisher, when the board adopted the rules to implement this statute, there was a lot of discussion along with the ODA and the Oregon Dental Hygienists Association about just exactly how to put in place the rules and specifically the charting and the referral process, and the board's position was it didn't want to be overly regulatory and get the limited access hygienist kind of between a rock and a hard place and responsible for something over which he or she couldn't have a lot of control. If I remember correctly, the conversations really had to do a lot with patients who are in nursing homes and adult foster care facilities where the patients are under the care of also a nursing and a care providing staff and probably have a physician, and the assumption was there would be a family dentist to make the referral on the chart in the patient record, which is a little bit of an expansion on the statute, would be satisfactory without the board being overly regulatory and just too controlling of a situation that was probably going to be taken care of well by nursing staff in the nursing homes.
Is there a way you can get information that would give some answers to Ms. Myers' questions concerning if referrals were actually taking place or not?
Senator Fisher, I'd be glad to contact the dental hygienists who have this permit currently and see if they have any records. And I understand that one of the hygienists is probably doing a survey of her peers. She asked for the information on the other licensees just recently, and I'd be glad to see if we can back to you.
This is going to be a volunteer operation for them. They have to send off 55 or 60
referrals and all the mailing and envelopes and everything, postage and record keeping and stuff that go up isn't going to influence anybody to be very willing to donate their time under those circumstances, I wouldn't guess. So I don't know, but I could foresee that there should be some type of possibly a look at that too, as far as an amendment goes, at the same time as we're looking at the one about the prison. So at least looking at how, if it can be done administratively, that's one thing, and I don't have a problem with that. If it needs to, wording needs to be changed or something, to exclude volunteers from having to keep records or something like that, if they're just doing a volunteer thing so that they verbally would tell somebody that their child needed it or something, then that would suffice. I'd feel a little more comfortable with having the people that are dealing with it professionally give us a little advice on that.
Mr. Chairman, Joanne, really quickly, can you tell me, what is the boundary that would allow a dental hygienist to practice anything in relationship to a dentist? Does it require an absolute relationship? In other words, you can't practice unless authorized, or can they do independent operations completely separated from a dentist? Just so I understand that whole framework.
Senator Fisher, Senator George, are you asking about limited access permit hygienists or dental hygienists in general?
Okay, tell me the difference.
Senator Fisher, Senator Georgia, a dental hygienist, for instance, let's just talk about a dental hygienist who does not have a limited access permit.
Right.
A dental hygienist must work under the general supervision of a dentist. The general supervision is defined in the statute as being under the authorization of a dentist, which we assume to mean that the dentist has examined or will very shortly examine the patient, depending on the service that's being provided. And the dentist does not have to be on the premises at the time, or the hygienist does not have to be in the same facility where the dentist is located.
But he is,
as long as the dentist has authorized the procedures.
Okay.
And then when we go back to what hygienists are authorized to do, their scope of practice is also defined by statute. A limited access permit dental hygienist is one who already has 5,000 hours of supervised practice, has obtained 40 hours of additional education beyond his or her dental hygiene program, and after the 5,000 hours of practice, if I'm interpreting it correctly, 40 classroom hours that your staff person already read you the list of, but including general medicine, pharmacology, medical emergencies, management and psychology of geriatric and disabled patients, and jurisprudence relating to unsupervised practice with limited access patients. Those limited access permit dental hygienists can function in certain facilities which are defined in the current statute unsupervised, as long as there are these referral processes in place. So there would need to be a dentist of record in the patient's chart in the facility. We're talking about a nursing home or an adult foster care, or a home that's operated through Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities Commission. There's maybe a couple of others. That's my understanding of the scope of the two.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
To follow up, that would be unsupervised, but would that be unauthorized? In other words, a dentist is...
Senator Fisher, yes. Senator George, that's correct. Okay. It would be unauthorized and unsupervised to a point.
With all of that background necessary and with a limited set of practice.
Okay. Yes.
We got it. Thanks.
Chair?
Yes, Senator Mesmer.
I'm not sure who to address this to, but maybe someone at the table can help me out. Who is presently taking care of the needs of patients in mental hospitals, in mental retardation centers, and nursery schools, public schools, and all these kind of facilities?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Messerly, the answer is different based on the kinds of institutions. The state still does fund some dental resources in its own institutions, although I believe those resources, as state dollars have become tighter, have been shrinking. The anticipation here is that the facilities that exist in those institutions that were built for staff there, that these people would come in on a volunteer basis and supplement the paid staff at the request of the paid staff to provide additional services in those institutions along with state employees. And I've spoken with Mary Bach and asked me, representative whose union represents, in fact, these kinds of professionals in those institutions, and she's aware of what we're doing here and is supportive. I think she would prefer to have more paid state staff that were doing it, but she understands the need. In schools, there are fewer schools now that have even public health nurses or school health nurses than there used to be. Although there are some programs through educational service districts and some school districts where public health nurses or school health nurses are in the facilities. To the extent screening goes on in schools, my understanding is that's done with a variety of resources, often volunteer. The Rural Health Coalition uses parents and a variety of other professionals they can have to come into schools to do hearing screening, eye screening, some kinds of screening for dental or oral health problems. Sometimes that's in conjunction with a nurse from the ESD or a school health nurse if one exists. Sometimes it's trained parents. Some cases our dental hygienists have been part of those teams, although they've been very clear that they can't do any dental hygiene services absent the authorization from this bill, but they can be part of the sort of the general screening team.
Mr. Chair, if I could follow up, it sounds to me like very little is being done by dentists themselves, and it's either by nurses or hygienists or on a volunteer effort. Is that true? And if that's true, it would seem to me it'd be pretty easy to get some pretty accurate figures on. And I guess the other part of my question is there a discrepancy between the kind of service that these kind of facilities would receive in rural Oregon compared to urban Oregon?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Messerly, I know that some dentists also participate as good community volunteers in doing some of these things, so I don't want to imply that they're never there, although, frankly, in rural Oregon, where they are fewer and further between, I think their ability to participate is probably, at least my feeling would be, lower simply because they need to be in their offices and they're so far from all of the spread-out schools in rural Oregon. I think it's also fair to say that the amount of services available in this area of healthcare, like almost every other kind of healthcare, is lower in rural Oregon than it is in urban Oregon. The shortage areas, the counties that have no dentists are in eastern Oregon. The counties that have shortage areas tend to be more rural counties. So I think you're correct in that assumption.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
If I could add something to answer Senator Messerly's question. The facilities that are covered in the law right now, these are primarily have to have some sort of state license to operate. And one of their requirements is whatever the health care that patient needs, it will be sought and provided for that patient. So, yes, many times the patient has to be transported to a dental office where the equipment to do the treatment is there. But we do have dentists who go to nursing homes and adult foster care homes and see patients. And many patients have dentists who are the family dentist who see them even when they are living in one of these facilities. The other part that I want you to know about is the Oregon Health Plan covers many of these patients in these facilities and buys dental care coverage for them. So there is a responsibility track, I guess I would say, that people are covered for dental care, and how they receive it is, you know, we do have to make sure everybody's making the right phone call and getting the patient the care they need. I think there is care out there. The report card the Rural Health Office did on the dentists in rural areas and whether they were working up to the terms of their agreement for a tax credit in the frontier counties, they got an A+. They have those agreements. They are seeing people who are not only in the Oregon Health Plan, but those who fall through the cracks, who are low income or no income and need care.
I have one more question.
Yes.
Senator Mitchell.
I have nothing in my bill file regarding the Dentist Association's objection to this. Have you received anything at the committee level as chair or the committee staff?
No, just
until today.
Just presentation.
My apologies, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for not getting more advice to you. It came up kind of quick for my scope.
Well, I think basically we've had a fairly good hearing on this, and it does appear that at least there's a couple of areas that I would also like to have you look into one of those employment training facilities where it says other employment training facilities, and perhaps be prepared to at least say what those are, you know, what that might cover, because I'm wondering if ABC Bookkeeping College would be a employment training or a...
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to do that. That was my words, although it made it through Legislative Council. The particular concern was some Job Corps training session locations, which are specifically mentioned, and I just was not knowledgeable enough to whether there are other similar kinds of employment that are just no longer called Job Corps. We'll try to get some more specification. It's that kind of facility we're looking at.
Well, we do have in Roseburg, we have Umpqua Training and Employment, and it is a program that is done by a private nonprofit corporation, but deals largely with grants and programs to get unemployed people back to work and retrain. And
we'll try to get some more.
I was wondering if that's the type of thing you were thinking about, or
we were looking for those kinds of training facilities that are not, they're day training, they're not overnight. Except I think some Job Corps may still be overnight, where people would be in need of services, and that would be a good place to provide them. That's what we were trying to define. We'll try to do a little bit better job defining those.
Okay, well, Mr. Chair, what are we lacking here? Some amendments? And amendments dealing with what?
One amendment would be dealing with putting the prison facilities, correction facilities in that were apparently left out. And the other, I guess, would be to try to see if there's something needed on the subparagraph 2 here of Section 1, where it says at least once each calendar year a dental hygienist issued a permit to access limited. This permit hygienist shall refer each patient or resident to a dentist who is available to treat the patient or resident, because if you're starting to go out here and get a lot of volunteer things, I'm guessing largely if you were in a nursing home, that kind of thing, you would at least have access to some type of reimbursement for that process, and that would be one thing if you're being reimbursed for it. But if you just had to go out and out of pocket records and notify all kinds of people and be sending off mailings, you know, individual mailings to families and all that kind of thing, it could get hugely expensive. And not only that, very, very time consuming, and probably defeat the purpose and stop anyone from being willing to do that. So we don't wish to do that, but in any event, those are the arenas that I would envisioning that we would have a little help on.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to clarify my earlier remarks. I am not supporting the multi-referrals documents like I mentioned, but it can be worked out was my point I was trying to make, and it shouldn't be burdensome to any parties. Matter of fact, I would think that just a notice in the patient's file would seem to me to be adequate.
Okay, I'm going to
thank you.
Close. You're welcome. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 562. And do we want to handle 69 and 70 together? Or do we want to do them individually?
Yes. Okay, so we'll do a public hearing on 569 quickly for the record.
Okay. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 569 for the record, and we have some folks coming forward here. I'll let you introduce yourselves and go ahead as you wish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Jennifer Weber, representing the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants, and we're here today in support of Senate Bill 569. The bill, current law allows physicians to supervise two physician assistants, and in medically underserved areas, as defined, to supervise up to four physician assistants with some exceptions. Senate Bill 569 makes it basically four across the board. Physicians in all areas of the state would be able to supervise up to four physician assistants.
Yeah, pardon me. I'm going to go to subcommittee status. Senator Mesrilli has a situation he needs to be excused for, so we'll continue for testimony purposes as a subcommittee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to share with you that we have discussed these bills with the Board of Medical Examiners, the regulatory body for physician assistants, and the Oregon Medical Association. And there are the Board of Medical Examiners Legislative Committee meets next week, and we'll discuss our bills at that time. So hopefully we'll deal with any concerns, or hopefully no concerns, that they have next week. And the OMA has shared some concerns with us that we're actually open to working with them to address any current concerns that they have. So having said that, I'll turn the mic. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kurt Hawkinson. I am a physician assistant from Salem, and I am the current president of the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants. As Ms. Weber mentioned, we are here today asking for support of Senate Bill 569, although we do understand that there are some issues with OMA that will need to be worked out. As you're well aware, Senator Fisher, the typical duties of a PA are to perform physical examinations, order laboratory studies, order x-rays, prescribe medications, and so forth. We feel that a change in the current statute for the number of PAs that may be supervised by a physician would serve the citizens of the state of Oregon. We feel that this will help increase access. In particular, there are certain instances when physician assistants work part-time that it may limit the number of PAs that could be employed in a practice because of the limit of two. If four could be employed, it would be more likely, as the example given in text in St. Helens, that that we could increase the access to care for Oregonians. I think it's important to mention that the governor's task force on racial and health care issues cited reducing practice barriers for physician assistants as a way to care better for medically underserved Oregonians, and we feel that this bill would allow us to do that.
Any of you want to move to Roseburg?
you find jobs, we'll find PAs. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee member, Jim Anderson, Oregon Medical Association. I assume, Mr. Chair, we are discussing Senate Bills 569 and 570 together.
I can open up a combination public hearing on both. I think they're quite similar, the reasons that we're opening the hearing, so we will consider the as a subcommittee hearing now on both Senate Bill 569 and 570.
Well, I thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Ms. Weber, her comments were right to the point, and I think she probably was addressing the basic issue contained in both pieces of legislation. The OMA does have some problems with these bills, but I think these are problems that we can work out. We are considering these two pieces of legislation to be works in progress, and we will be attending, hopefully attending, along with the PAs, the meeting on the 27th with the Board of Medical Examiners. There are some shortcomings in these bills, and there is some language that has been deleted from present statute that I think we need to reinsert. It's issues like that that we need to get around and work together on.
Yeah, we'd be very delighted if you do that and come back and present us with it.
We will do our best.
Case closed situation. Okay. Did you wish to comment either Ms. Weber or on the 570?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could, I would like to briefly comment on Senate Bill 570. Again, coming back to the duties of physicians, and the duties of physician assistants and how that relates with supervision. As you review this language, what this will do is allow PAs to be supervised in the same manner in which they currently are, but it will change the requirement. I guess what I'm trying to say is it is laid out in statute and administrative rules, a definition of supervision. That would not change under these bills. Scope of practice would not change under Senate Bill 570. What would, however, change is the direct on-site supervision of PAs. Currently, PAs can be supervised remotely only in medically underserved areas. Unfortunately, there are areas in Oregon which do not have adequate health care coverage, which may not be federally designated or designated by the offices of rural health as being underserved. We feel this bill would help to, again, increase the access. I think it's important to remember that in both of these bills, 569 and 570, the Board of Medical Examiners still has to approve each practice. I think that's important. You're not going to have physicians in Portland supervising PAs in Coos Bay. I just can't imagine the Board of Medical Examiners would ever allow that to happen. I think that's an important provision. There's some safeguards in here. I would also say that OSPA certainly is very open to working out the issues of language with the OMA. That's very important. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have. Thank you.
I don't think I have any at this time. I'll be anxious to hear how things go. And I apologize. We don't always know when some meetings take place. And unfortunately, it's very difficult. It's hard enough to schedule meetings of your organizations and the boards and things, let alone try to fit it in with that. Half a dozen schedules in the state legislature. So thank you for your alerting me to the fact that there were problems this morning, and I certainly am not interested in pushing the issue and would be happy to give you the time to work through these. Right. So
thank you, Mr. Chair.
It will depend on you to let us know when you want us to get these back into process again.
We absolutely will.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you have no further testimony, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 569 and 570, and our committee is adjourned. Oh, good. Tom Wilson.